Met it for about 15 years, and then one of my top people, Gary Pink, went to Amana as chief designer, and that was it.
You wished him well.
Yeah, no, he's done a fine job. He's a good man, and he came from Cedar Rapids, Iowa.
Oh, perfect.
So he lived in the town, his family was there, and it was perfect for him.
Couldn't be better.
In the meantime, of course, we do a lot of truck design. We have the Fruhoff account. We design trailers for Fruhoff. We're designing trucks for Mack. We have the Scheller Globe account.
What does Scheller Globe do?
Scheller Globe makes instrument panels, steering wheels. They have, I think, 43 plants building automotive components. We design all the sub-assemblies of the cars. We have Creative and Modern Engineering, where we do all of their models and design for them on projects that come to them for engineering.
Mm-hmm.
So we're their design wing, you might say. So it affords us a nice program.
Scheller Globe does a lot of work for Ford, is that right?
Oh, yes. Very big vendor.
Are you directly back into Ford, or is that the only indirect contact?
Well, we periodically do programs for Ford. I did a prototype for Ford last year.
Really? What was
it?
We
called it the Stallion. It was a Mustang.
Yeah.
A real macho Stallion. We built a full-size prototype, took it out to Don Kopka and Jack Telnak, and presented it to them. And we got a very nice letter from Mr. Knighton, who was their, I think he's executive vice president of Ford now, for what we've done for them and so on.
Uh-huh.
And we're doing a new Corvette right now for General Motors, a special edition convertible Corvette.
Uh-huh.
We're building a full-size model and so on.
That's smart.
Which is exciting. I've done a lot of work with Chrysler since Donald Rosa worked for me for 9 years and is now vice president.
He was one of your assistants.
He was assistant in charge of the Lincoln.
Oh, that's right.
So we've had a very close relationship. We're doing a new truck as of this week for Western Star out in the far reaches of Canada.
Wonderful.
Big logging and mining type of trucks. We do a small scale model, all the design, and then we do a full size mock up and prototype. So it's an exciting business, and it varies so much, it's what makes it more exciting, you know.
What attributes do you see that the combination of fortunate circumstances, but your own abilities and your own ability to sell yourself and your company in terms of industrial design? Can you give us some insight into how this process works? You're obviously competing with a lot of other companies.
Oh, yes. I guess I'd have to say, Dave, that first of all, a company has to have a need for your design, building a new truck. Maybe they don't have a staff in-house to do it. They have a good engineering staff, good production facilities, and so on, but they must come up with a truck that's going to live 10 to 15 years. So if you design a truck in 1984, it's got to be good for the year 2000. So you had to be pretty much up to date on the technology of today, what it should be like, and be strong enough to sell management. We're sometimes reluctant to take that step of going way out and say, well, we think that's too far advanced for us. But it isn't. And you must convince them of that. I find that the older I get, the easier it is to convince people, because they think you should have more experience and background. When I was 30-some years old, it was tough as hell. They said, what can you tell us that we don't know about trucks? I've gone into accounts like when we first went to Alice Chalmers, and we went down to Independence, Missouri, where they make the Gleaner Combine. The Gleaner Combine is the Cadillac of the industry, not in volume, but in quality and also in capability. They wanted a new combine with all new equipment, a new rotary cylinder concept, which was excellent, which they had designed. And we were to house this whole thing with new cabs and all the rest of the sheet metal. I went down with two of my men, and they had a meeting of about 12 of their people. They had a gentleman there named Bill Barber, who was Mr. Combine. He'd been there since 1923. And he said, Mr. Schmidt, what? He says, did you ever live on a farm? I said, no, sir. Did you ever operate a combine? I said, no, sir. He said, have you ever seen a combine? I said, no, sir. He says, what in hell makes you think you can design a combine for us better than we can? He said, I've been designing these things from 1923. When were you born? 1921. He says, then what makes you think you can tell us how this thing should be? My answer, of course, had to be based on experience that, Mr. Barber, our job is to come in, make a study of your product, all of your competition, find out the good and bad points of every one of them, what's it going to take to have a better product than your competition? And based on experience and intelligence and good common sense, put it all together in a package that makes common sense. He says, well, I'll believe it when I see it. We designed the Gleaner Combine, and it took us 2 years.
2 years?
2 years. Large staff.
On contract all that time.
All that time. And as a result of it, we built the first full-size prototype in their plant, right there with our people operating there. It went out and it behaved so good, it would turn out 2.5 bushels of wheat per second. Operative prototype.
Yeah.
2.5 bushels of wheat a second. The best anybody in the industry can do was John Deere, was 1.5 bushels a second. So we almost doubled what they could do. We also won the National Design Award for agricultural products in the whole world that year with the Gleaner Company. As a result of that, their productions went up and their sales went up, and of course it's a $100,000 machine, so you don't sell one every day, but they doubled their sales. I went back for a meeting after some 2 years and met Mr. Barber again, who was about ready to retire. I said, Bill, I just came back to tell you that a couple of years ago I was in here and you asked me what made you think I could do a job. And I said, well, I think we've done a job. I said, I just wanted to let you know that we really tried real hard. He said, Bill, you certainly did. He says, I couldn't believe what's happened, and I take off my hat to him. And it really made me feel good, you know. He was such a gentleman about it.
Well, how does this come about? Can you put your finger, you mentioned some of the aspects a moment ago, but can you put your finger on how that could happen?
Well, in the first place, they have designed the working chassis, you know, the engine, the diesel engines, their rotary screens, and those are known engineering systems that go into the thing. We designed a new cab that would put all the electronics up, almost like a B-47 for the operator to use, makes it a very safe machine to use, a very functional machine. We improved on entrance and egress, we improved on lighting, we air conditioned the vehicle. We did a great many things for the operator's comfort, which they like very much. They're in this thing from early morning till late at night. So
ergonomics had not been heard of in the
farm. No, sir. This is
farm implements.
That's right. So, you know, a lot of it is information you're compiling from other things that you've done. We've designed truck cabs and army cabs and so on. So you apply a lot of that information to it, and it's not an unknown factor, but it's putting it all together in one package. We had an excellent staff. We only used about 6 people on the program, but they really knew what they were doing, and we really became so familiar with that, I can draw it in my sleep, any part of it, you know. So you really have to know the product, and then we went out and really studied our competition. And as a result, we came up with a real winner. And so we got a long-term contract, 10-year contract, and we're still doing it.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Well, that's a real success story. Have you had any failures in recent years that you'd like to talk about?
No. I must say.
Or without names.
Most of the failures in our case happen not because of a bad design job, in my estimation, but because of politics within a company. You go into a company and maybe the executive vice president is asking you to come in and study their products and recommend what should be done. Mm-hmm. You might have a vice president of engineering or somebody in-house who doesn't want it done outside the house.
Who resents your intrusion.
And makes it very difficult. Yeah. And those are rare, but it does happen, and I'd say in the last 15 years, maybe 3 times, where we really haven't succeeded with the product because somebody in management has not wanted it or has fought us or had another company they're trying to sell in our stead. It does happen. As your reputation grows and your successes accumulate, it's easier to sell. You sell by reputation. We don't advertise or anything, so it has to be word of mouth. You know, somebody's happy and says, hey, if you're going to do a new product, get a hold of Bill Schmidt. Well, that's the best kind of recommendation, you know. So we have had some failures, but
not
I choose to forget.
Poor design.
I don't think so.
Poor conception.
We have never had, now, like when we first started out, we realized that a lot of the products we were going to do could injure somebody. So we took out $1 million worth of product, for safety insurance. Never had to use it.
Really?
I've been in business now since 40, and we've never had one occasion to use it. That makes me feel pretty damn good. So So we're pretty careful.
Your mix of available design services has grown and broadened in the last 25 years.
Yes, it has.
What other fields have you been happy working into? You mentioned robotics. Is that a recent?
Last 5 years, robotics has had quite an upsurge. We've designed complete lines of robotics, from very small robots to very huge robots.
Now you're in competition with several firms in this area.
There's got to be a half a dozen,
especially in Michigan. Mm-hmm. How's that working out?
Robots themselves, the whole industry has sort of taken a slow up period, you might say, because like the Japanese are producing 3 times or 4 times as many robots as all the companies in the United States combined. And the larger companies like GM and GE and so on, making their own.
Yeah.
So they're not buying them on the outside. So they're really the need for robot building companies is narrowing down to 2 or 3 big companies like Micron and people of that nature. ASEA from Sweden is a very large one. But the smaller companies are falling by the wayside because there's not the need for the product.
But you're in a particularly good position because you can offer services, design services.
Right.
Do you give us a typical case where, take us from the beginning to beginning of the contact with the company that wants you to do this, and take us step by step, if you could, in terms of finally getting to the finished product, how it works.
Well, for instance, at Copperwell Robotics, Jerry Kirsch is the president of Copperwell Robotics. Very, very inventive engineer, tremendous personality, a real driving force, and with a lot of foresight. Jerry just won a medal from Germany as being the greatest robot engineer in the United States for last year, that type of thing. A very, very, very strong man. I know Jerry from a personal relationship at the Grosse Pointe Yacht Club, where I've been a member for a long time. And Jerry called me one day and said, "Bill, come on over and have lunch. I want to talk to you." I went over and talked to him, and he said, "Well, here's what we're building." And he took me back into the engineering laboratories, and they had all these machines that were doing all these various things, and some were using tapes to control it. And he had combined that with cameras, small cameras that would be eyes for the robot and take pictures and study for castings that had flaws in them.
Eyes in the sense, was it infrared or?
Well, eyes in the sense that if you had a series of engine blocks coming down a conveyor line, mm-hmm. the camera would actually take pictures of the exterior, and a laser beam would take picture of the inside, and they find out if there were any flaws in the castings and so on. Robot would come in and pick out the one that the camera eye said was flawed, and take it out and set it aside, and so they did quite a job. A combination of products.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they were very basic, angle iron and wires and all sorts of boxes put together and so on. It really looked awful. So we worked with Jerry for 3 years, I guess it was, and developed a complete line of small, medium-sized, and large robots, complete with fiberglass housings, and the corporate logos. We designed their showrooms and their conference rooms and their exterior, their buildings and their signages, and everything to present the product to their public. We also designed their exhibits to go down into the Dearborn when they had the big shows and robots and so on. So really everything that has to do with what the public sees of their company, the product, the exhibits, their offices, their showrooms, and so on. We did everything for them, and they had a tremendous line of products. They still have those. But the volume need is the big hindrance right now.
Uh-huh.
We spent a lot of money over the 3 years developing all this.
And the need is
shrinking.
Mm-hmm.
And the larger companies are taking more and more of it. But that's a general picture of how we're called in to do a job. Usually we have to go in, Dave, and spend a month or two on orientation. And that really means finding out what the product's all about, talking to their engineers, talking to product planners, talking to their marketing men. What do their clients want in a product? Marketing will say, "Well, we've been trying to get engineering to do this for 3 years, but why don't we do it? We put it on the list." And then we study competition. There's 6 major manufacturers. Here's the products they make. What's good about each one? What's bad? How do the salespeople feel about their products? So we try and put a list of all the good products down and what we don't want, and stay away from those things which they don't like. And eventually you start compiling a picture of your own new product. And then with the new materials for housings and with electronics and with keyboards and everything that you can do today with computers, why, we can really do a tremendous job.
This is a fairly esoteric thing, at least it seems so to the layman. Have you kept your expertise in this field, and when it opens up again, you'll be perhaps...
It's really not any different than any other field. You know, we go into agricultural equipment, we have to learn all about it before we can design a product.
So you really don't consign yourself to one area. You're available for a wide range of...
That's right. In fact, we have rolls and rolls of carousels of products over the years. If you had the time, I'll show it to you sometime, but it's unbelievable.
I'd love to see it. Give us an idea, in some detail, if you can, your work with consumer products over the years.
Much less, actually, than products for industry. We usually work for large corporations.
You've done some work for Amana, as I recall.
Oh, yes, we've done that. We've done work for the RCA with TV sets. We've done furniture for a lot of companies. We have a client down in Miami. We build executive office furniture, desks, and credenzas, and so on.
Well,
it's so varied, it's just hard to bring it all back. But we do, industrial design really covers the gamut. Now, we do everything from doorknobs to faucets. We'll take and redesign a complete line of faucets. We've done toilets for Norris Thermador out in California. We do toilet seats for Beneke and people like that. Oddly enough, there's just not much in this world that you see today that can't be designed better.
That's interesting.
And that's the look we take on.
You have no limitations. There are probably some things you've refused over the years, but...
Well, there are. Like, we get in the medical field. We've designed a lot of medical equipment and so on. But once in a while, it requires too much in-depth engineering knowledge. And we either have to bring somebody in-house to help handle that who's an expert in that field, or refuse it entirely.
That's what intrigues me. You're a design service organization, and yet you apparently do not have a full-time... full-time staff to handle the support engineering. Do you bring that in as the job required?
Well, I have a full-time staff of 10 people in this building, and when we require architectural work, we bring in a man who's an architectural renderer.
Mm-hmm.
If we have a structural study and we want to know snow loads and so on, we bring in an expert for that particular job. Mm-hmm. We're doing some medical equipment right now, and I bring in a specialist on just engineering, pounds pressure required, that type of engineering, which we're not capable of. Bring an expert in, pay him as much as is need to be done, because we don't need him for very long.
Right.
And you can't afford to keep those people on the staff all the time, because your jobs are intermittent, you know. But that's the way we handle it. We have a large outlying staff of experts that we can call on, who are doctors and everything else, to do the job.
As consultants.
Mm-hmm.
So you offer a full design and... But you, in effect, you farm the engineering out.
That's right.
Right, yeah. And you have your companies that you've dealt with in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Does it work pretty well?
Well, I think so. I'm enjoying my life, and it's been a very successful business. And, you know, most people retire from the automobile company and become a consultant.
Uh-huh.
I've been a consultant now for 30 years, and I like the freedom that affords me. And I like the challenge of getting into new and different products all the time.
What do you see for the future of design engineering and the air design, industrial design in the next 50 years? Is it going to take a radical new direction, or is it going to go pretty much the same as it's gone in the last 50 years?
No, I'd say it is going to change. I can see now that the small design houses will disappear.
Mm-hmm.
In my estimation, the big houses will want to offer a turnkey operation, from concept to finished product.
Mm-hmm.
And your advertising houses are buying up a lot of industrial design houses.
Are they?
One recently bought 3 industrial design companies in New York.
That's interesting.
So that they can say, you come to us for your advertising, we also design your product, do your packaging, do your logo,
mm-hmm.
and put it into your brochures, and a complete service. And because they're so much larger and with the capital to work with, they can afford to bring in better people. So I see that happening in the future. I see the small companies disappearing and there'll be a few big companies like in every other industry.
So firms like your own will be a rarity in the next...
That's right. And we've been approached by three different companies in the last 2 years to purchase us.
What kind of deals did they offer you?
Well, excellent. Unfortunately, I guess I'm the problem because I personally don't want to assign my time of my own private life to anybody. We had an advertising company and two top-notch worldwide engineering companies. Just tremendous companies.
Wanted to make you an...
Want us to be a division, a wholly owned division, so they can go out and say, we can offer you... They can go to Sweden and get a Volvo car and say, we'll design it, model it, engineer it, tool it, put it in production, give you the prototype, wrap-up story. That's what they're after. It's good for us, too, because it's constant business. And it takes the worry off of selling new contracts all the time.
Are you wavering?
Well, I've been thinking about it for 2 years, but so far I haven't.
Would be very lucrative then.
Oh yes, oh yeah. Money wise, it's excellent. But freedom wise, and I guess I have to say,
that's more important.
My way of life is important to me.
Yeah.
I have a place up on Lake Huron. I go up every Thursday afternoon. I take Fridays off because I have a plant a mile from my cottage, which I can go to. I take 10 days out of every month during the winter time and go to my home in Florida, and I take the month of January and go to Florida. I even had one of the companies say, we will guarantee you 10 days a month in Florida in a written contract and the month of Florida if you want the damn thing, which is a contract we've never given to anybody, including me, and this was the president talking, but we would really like to do this. And they put it in writing, and I have the contract if I want to sign it. But it's still not the same. I wouldn't feel as free to do that, whereas today I've got an excellent staff and I have a tremendous man in Stan Thorwald, my executive vice president. Been with me 38 years.
38 years.
Now when I leave, I know it's in good hands and a very honest guy, a very capable designer, and I don't have to worry about it.
Stan Thorwald.
Yeah. He was with me at Ford.
Was he?
Studebaker Packard.
He brought him with
Chrysler,
him all through his various moves. Yeah. That's great. Must be marvelous to have a man like him, loyal and competent.
It certainly is.
A man you can leave in charge when you're away.
Never worry.
What trends have you liked in industrial design over the last 35 years of your career? What you can think back and reflect on the things that your career impacted on, but others too. Has the automobile industry, have they availed themselves of all the resources of industrial design, or have they rather been rather insular in their thinking?
I'd have to say that up until recently, most companies never went outside. For industrial design. You had your own design staffs, own engineering staffs, it wasn't necessary. I think that's changing. I'd say that today we've been approached by Ford Motor Company and their SVO operations to design a new special car based on the T-Bird. We're working on a Corvette now for one of the GM divisions.
Is this an experimental Corvette?
This would be a special edition car.
Special edition, with a racing
flag. Yeah, very macho and a convertible, which they don't have, and so on.
Right.
Limited edition.
Still fiberglass?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And Chrysler goes outside for a great deal of work now, and it has American Sunroof and Creative and Modern and a lot of different houses working on programs, even IDEA in Italy and some of the other firms.
Mm-hmm.
So they're now going outside to get a lot of this work done because it's less expensive, requires less staff in-house, and they get a very specialized job. A lot of these people are experts in what they're doing. I think we're going to see more and more of that in the future than we have in the past. It's been a very...
Outsourcing of technical abilities and design abilities.
Right.
The you mentioned American Sunroof. That's been sort of a local success story, hasn't it?
Oh, it sure has.
Can you tell us a bit about the founder and what's
that? Well, I really can't. I know he's a young man and he's very, very successful. He started with the sunroof patents.
Mm-hmm.
And he's built that into really customizing whole cars. He's doing a complete line of convertibles, and
mm-hmm.
he's doing a lot of packages. And I think that's one of the trends where these small design firms do a special thing, take it to a Cadillac or a Lincoln or something, and they want 5,000 of a type,
mm-hmm.
but it's too small production to be seriously interested in-house, and they give it to an American Sunroof. Cars and Concepts is another.
Yes.
And as an indication of how business is going out to these companies, Cadillac just gave Pininfarina in Italy a contract for $600 million to do 5 years of Cadillac special custom bodies to go on the Cadillac Seville. Over 5 years, a $600 million contract is a sizable contract.
Yes, incredible.
And that's one. And another man, not Bertone, one of them has made a special Corvette, which you can see in the automotive news, and has taken it to GM, and they're talking about building a special deluxe job. He's after a very large contract, too. Cars and Concepts is doing that in a way.
Where are they located?
I think in Troy or Birmingham, that area.
And Sunroof is in, American Sunroof is where? North of
Nottingham? I think they have three or four different plants. I know they're in Detroit someplace.
Yeah.
But these companies now are getting capable of doing not just a sunroof, but a customized Eldorado or things of that nature. And if you want a limited volume, it's a cheap way to go. You don't have any plant expenditures or anything, you just give the contract up.
So, persons like yourself and Sunroof and Cars and Concepts have really afforded the industry a chance to get unique designs and without having an in-house staff to support it.
Well, I don't put ourselves in the same class as American Sunroof and Cars and Concepts. They're production houses.
Of course, yeah.
We're a design house,
you're
strictly.
Designers, yeah.
But from a design standpoint, yes, that's
yes.
correct.
I've always been interested, and maybe you can expound on this at some length, I've been interested in the Italian connection, starting with, I think almost all the industries have worked with Ghia, almost all the automotive companies worked with Ghia over the years, and also you mentioned Pininfarina and others. Can you give us sort of a capsule history of the Italian connection to the automotive industry, the American automotive industry?
Well, the Italians have been known for automotive design for a long time, and a flair of design. Excuse me, can I?
Sorry to interrupt. The Cardinal's been trying to get a hold of you all morning.
Oh, has he?
This is the second time.
Is he on now?
Yeah.
Can you excuse me for a moment? Well, with regard to the Italian influence, Dave, I'm sure that one of the real founders of this thing was Mr. Farina. As an excellent designer, of course he died I think 15 years or so and his son has taken over, but he has an excellent engineer there now, and they've increased their facilities such they even have a wind tunnel now that the Italian government has built for them, one of the few in the world. They're a very capable organization, and there are many others, Di Tommaso as you say, and one of the real beginners of the relationship with the United States design was Luigi Segre, president of Ghia. Now, at that time, it was a privately owned company. Today, it's part of Ford. But in those days, Luigi came over here, and he was a personal friend of Tex Colbert, so he did 50 Chrysler limousines for Tex. And they mostly were given to the top people in the country as prestige Chrysler cars for $1 a year type of thing. Like the editor of the New York Times got one, and so on, you know. Luigi would sell the Ford family on doing a lot of show cars. Did a lot of cars for Ford. Did some work for GM, I don't know how much, and some for American Motors, but he was a very outgoing, personable guy, and a salesman primarily, but just a lovable guy, always laughing and joy of life. Unfortunately, he died early in life of an infection. He is one of the ones that started. Farina, of course, was one. Di Tommaso was one. Bertone. And the Italians have always had a flair for design, whether it's clothes or jewelry or shoes or cars or you name it. not always the construction to follow it up. Like Italian sports cars always had a lot of wiring problems and so on, but the flair for design. That's true from the medieval times. They would build armor in Turin. You know, that's where the metal workers originally came from. And so they're very expert and good craftsmen. A lot of that died out when the young apprentices didn't follow their father and continue on the arts. But now that's back in demand again. There are schools to do this. And new design houses have cropped up, like Ital Design and IDEA, which is very strong. And they're pretty complete organizations. They can design it and model it and build it and prototype it, and it's a complete service. So a lot of the companies, I know particularly Chrysler, is very interested. I think Mr. Di Tommaso is a personal friend of Mr. Iacocca. Don Della Rosa has a lot of friends over there, and he's vice president of design because he was over there for 2 years running GIA for Ford. He was in charge of that responsibility. So the knowledge is there. I know that the Fisher Body Group has sent a task force of people to look at all these companies to see if they can build special cars for GM. A great deal of interest in the Italian influence. I think it will continue. I think a lot of it could be done here. I personally feel we can do just as good a job. Naturally, I would feel that way. But I do, and I think that the reputation has a great deal to do with it. Get a reputation. And, you know, if you look at some of the old cars that Farina did for George Mason, for instance, American Motors, they're god-awful. I mean, but he did enough good cars to make the reputation. So we all have some successes, and we all have some bad ones. Right now, the Italian influence is very strong and growing.
Is it?
Oddly enough, a lot of the people working in the design area are from the United States.
Yeah, I understand that Tom, John Chardis' son was working, Tom was working over there.
Right.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
John Pinko went over there, and he's at Chrysler, you know, and a lot of people that used to work here over there.
Bertone and Di Tommaso are still have very strong contacts with the American automobile industry.
I know Di Tommaso does with Mr. Iacocca personally. I don't know the others.
Well, Bertone was in town recently, I think, on some sort of a trip, talking to General Motors and other people.
Yeah.
Do you remember the Di Tommaso creation that was done for Lincoln Mercury 20 years ago?
No, can't say I do. Not the Pantera.
The Pantera, yeah. Do you know anything about that?
Not a great deal. I've seen the car, very low. I don't know how big a success it was.
It was marketed through Lincoln Mercury dealers, I think.
Did they sell many?
No, they had mechanical problems, apparently.
That's what I said.
Well, it was a gorgeous car.
Oh, it was a good looking car. Yeah, that's right. Well, he now has two or three companies, I believe. He has... Well, I can't think of the names of them right now, but I think he bought a couple of other companies in Italy.
Yeah.
And, not Ferrari, but what's the other one? Very well-known racing team. So he had, and he has a lot of ins with the Italian government, I understand.
The Fiat? Where are you thinking of?
No. Can't think of it. But he's been around a long time, you know, he bonded to meet a lot of people. And he's aggressive.
There have been a couple of entrepreneurs over the years, like Di Tommaso in the American field. I was trying to think of that one marvelous automobile that everyone liked, and the Bricklin.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know anything about the background of that, how that came about?
Not too much, Dave. I think that the concept of the car is excellent, frankly. I like the gull wing, and I like the overall look, and I guess they had financial problems, but I personally thought that was a pretty good job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
well regarded by aficionados. Mm-hmm. But apparently they had some...
It takes a lot more money than most of these people think to do a program like that. You know, you think, oh boy, after we start selling the first 100, we're going to have money rolling back in. Well, it takes an awful lot of money, you know.
Now, you've been doing custom... car work, aside from the big companies. Can you tell us a bit about that aspect of your business?
Most of that we do through other companies, like we do special custom car. I just finished a two-seater Chrysler convertible for Mr. Iacocca through Creative Engineering. And
they're located where?
It's located here in Detroit on Otter Drive. Mm-hmm. And I modeled it for 3 months, personally stayed there from 7 in the morning till 11 at night, and I just took 3 months out of my business here.
You always said you wanted to stay on the drawing board.
Oh yeah, I like to stay on the drawing board. But in this case, it was much more than just the drawing. We did a full-size clay model on an operating chassis. And I recently did a special Corvette, which is a macho car, and very aerodynamic, and convertible, and with all of the spoilers and all the rest of the package put together as a special edition car. Maybe only 5,000 of them would be built.
It'll be something to counter the Ford SVO effort, perhaps?
That's the type of thing.
Yeah.
Whether they're going to do it or not, we don't know yet, but yeah, right. I hope so. At least we've done the work on it. We've done, I did a special car for Datsun 2 years ago, and I flew over to Tokyo, got the contract, came back, they shipped the car over by plane, put it in the studio, and in 90 days I had a full-size finished model. We made clays, fiberglass cast, put the panels all back together, painted it a bright silver, and put it on a plane and shipped it back to Tokyo.
Oh, marvelous.
And the contract read that it was to be a car designed by an American designer for the American public, because the Japanese wanted to test that. I got it back over and I made my presentation to the president of Datsun, Nissan, and they decided that they're going to produce it in Tokyo. So it came out as the Langley, believe it or not, and it's only sold in Japan.
Where did they get the name?
I don't know, but I've got pictures of it, and it's in production.
That's marvelous.
2 years ago, yeah. So we like those kind of projects. You know.
Now, is your place in Port Sanilac to handle most of that?
No, we did the design here. We did the modeling at Creative, Modern in this case.
Mm-hmm. Modern.
And they have a tremendous facility. They have 12 plants out here. So I took over a whole building and just did this car in that time. We had a very large modeling. We had 16 modelers working on it around the clock. Boy, that was a big push. But those are good once in a while. You can't do them all the time.
Yeah.
You
know? Yeah. What sort of custom creations are you coming up with in your plan at Port Sanilac?
Well, right now we're building 6 stretch limousines a week.
What kind of limousines are they?
Cadillac, basically. And we stretch them 24, 36, 42, and 54 inches, and we have TV and bars and all the rest. And they're sold mostly to the syndicates, not individuals, some to individuals.
What do you mean by syndicates?
Well, people that lease out limousines in New York City, Chicago, Los Angeles, Philadelphia, they buy them by fleets.
Mm-hmm.
And so we take their fleet order and spread it over a period of 52 weeks, mm-hmm. and then we build them out like that. We build 110 Chrysler convertibles before the Chrysler convertibles came out.
Oh, did you?
The
as
first
pilot models?
Pilot models.
Uh-huh.
And we build classics in very limited volume because it's a $60,000 car. So we don't sell a lot of them. But
one of yours, you call it the
Classic.
The Cadillac Classic.
Yeah, Eldorado. There's a picture of it on the wall that I started with. And I've been driving one for 5 years now.
I noticed that in the parking lot.
Yeah.
It's gorgeous.
We have quite a few of them in Detroit. I think there are 6 or 7 in Detroit.
Now tell me, what is the appeal of, besides your own, what is the appeal?
Well, we start out with a car that it probably was the ultimate in computerized technology. Mm-hmm. It's a real fine automobile to start with.
Yeah.
We cut it in half. Uh-huh. We throw away the rear seat. We take the front seats and move them back where the rear seats were. And we take the windshield and the firewall and the A-pillars and move them all back. So you get a long hood, 72-inch
mm-hmm.
long hood.
Mm-hmm.
But the car is no longer than the regular Eldorado, and we don't touch the wheelbase. So it's exactly the same length, but it's now a two-seater.
Uh-huh.
Now, by doing that, we don't change the warranty on the car because we don't affect the drivetrain.
Mm-hmm.
So you take it to any Cadillac dealer, any place in the world, get service on it. The next thing we did was we made a real study from my library of all the most important features on custom cars in the 30s and up to about 34, the Duesenbergs, Cords, Pierce Arrows, and so on, Cadillacs. And so we put about a dozen features like the oval window, the trunk lid, the luggage rack on the back, the pipes on the side, the wire, real wire wheels. Those are $1,200 wire wheels on that car.
Oh.
And we build these cars in all steel. There's no fiberglass in the car.
That's good.
And it's all steel hoods, all hammered out by hand, all from the technology we gleaned from the Italians. Mm-hmm. We have about 8 people that can do that work now up at the plant. Well, it takes us 90 to 120 days to build one, so you know that they're really well built. We have 40 coats of paint on them. When we get through, we put in security systems, so if you touch the car, the bells ring and the lights go on. And we have a special air horn system, and we have refrigerators, and we have everything else. It's a tremendous excitement to drive this car. I drive it every day of my life. Snow, sleet, rain, and I've got over 70,000 miles on my car. And we got them pretty well spaced around the United States. And it's just a fun thing. I enjoy it.
How many have you made?
Well, we were building one every 120 days. It's about 3 a year. So I think we've only got about 8 or 10 out total.
What do they retail for?
$60,000.
$60,000.
Well, that's the base price. And we also build rumble seats on them, all glass removable tops, swivel doors. For instance, you take the hardware off a car, you got a push button. Push the button, the flip top mini go wing doors swing up, the seat swivels out, and the door opens hydraulically. So you just sit down in the seat, swing your legs in, and all closes around you. We call that our easy entrance system. We have a complete rumble seat that we designed with ball bearings and 4 different sets of tracks and 7 electric switches that you press a button on the dash, the rumble seat goes up and swings down so you can see over it. The windshield, which is in the rumble seat compartment, swings up in front of you with air wings swinging out, all on a bell crank system, all automatic. So those go for about $72,500.
Sounds like the state of the art.
Well, it is still a nostalgic car. It's the very latest in technology, but it also has the nostalgia of the 1930s.
That reminds me of an anecdote you told me earlier that the you had fashioned for Mrs. Edsel Ford one of the first stand-up entrance and egress devices on a limousine. Was that the Continental she drove?
That was a 19. First one was a 49 Lincoln, and we did a second one on a 52 Lincoln. Mrs. Edsel Ford suffered from arthritis, and she had a back problem. She couldn't bend over easy to get in a car, so we took the 52 and raised it up. I believe it was 67 inches, the total height of the car. And we took the doors up into the roof, so when you opened the door, part of the roof came away, and she could literally walk in and sit down on the seat rather than bending over. She drove that until her death.
That's right.
She never changed that car. She just loved it.
Great. She must have... in effect, blessed you every time she got into the car for making it so easy for her.
Well, I never met her, but I knew the problem and was told what we had to do. I never met her personally, but she must have been a very nice woman. The other one that was exciting, and I did forget to tell you about, was the presidential limousine.
Oh, yes, too.
We designed a limousine for President Eisenhower. I went down to Washington, and Secret Service took us to the White House and found out what he wanted and what he didn't want. We came up with what we called the glass bubble car.
Mm-hmm.
Where the president could sit inside either it was raining or not and still be seen by the public. And
that was your innovation?
That was ours, yeah. And that was an exciting trip. I remember the day that I went down there, we were to see the president early in the morning, and he told us he wasn't going to be available till later in the day. And the Secret Service suggested we go out to Mount Vernon, which is not too far away, 25 miles. So we got a car and drove out to Mount Vernon, and they gave us a driver. Went through Mount Vernon, we were coming back, and 5 o'clock traffic, just unbelievable, 4 lanes wide, and all of a sudden here's this terrific jam of cars, it looked like 2 miles long, unbelievable, nobody moving, bumper to bumper, horns honking, everybody's hot in Washington, you know. And we finally got up to this thing about a half hour later, and here's a roadblock. And here are the police and sirens going and motorcycle cops and everything. And the fellow stuck his head in the door and he was in plain clothes and he said, "You Mr. Schmidt?" "My God, yes." "Yeah, I found them fellas," and I thought I'd committed adultery or something, you know. And what had happened is the president had been freed up and the Secret Service was told to get me back there in a hurry. They knew I'd be coming back from Mount Vernon. They had a roadblock on the road. I had three policemen out in front on motorcycles and two followers, and we went whining through the city till we got back to the White House and went in and saw the president. I thought I was going to collapse. How did anybody know my name in Washington, you know? So we had a very interesting meeting. He said to me, Mr. Smith, one of the problems is that when I'm standing up in the car, traveling down the highway, bugs hit me in the eye. So we designed a flip top coming off the driver's seat that folded up in front of plexiglass. People could see through it, but he wasn't affected by it. And then we put a glass bubble over him to protect him from the rain. Then we broke the glass bubble up into sections, two side sections, a top section and a back section, so it could all be taken apart and put into a valise so the Secret Service could take it to any city and put it on any big blanket. So that was a very successful car, and it's in the museum now.
Henry Ford Museum.
Yes.
Right. Now, I was with your work with Benson Ford at the Lincoln Mercury Division. That reminds me of something you said earlier. The availability and the ability of American industrial designers. One of the more successful schools in the area is the Center for Creative Studies in Detroit.
That's correct.
Have you had any input over the years into that?
Yes. Matter of fact, Stan Thorolson is one of the instructors. He's an instructor in industrial design, and he works for Homer Agassi, who used to be a Ford designer, is now the professor of industrial design and automotive design. Very successful, and I think directly as the results of Homer Agassi's personal influence. He's made it the number one school in the world. Los Angeles Arts Center has been for 15 years or 20 years the only school to go to. We're now, creative school is ranked higher.
You say it's largely, not largely, but one of the main reasons has been Homer Agassi's vision of a...
Personally, his own background, his own drive, his own foresight, I give him great credit for it.
And they're turning out very successful young designers.
Ford and GM and so on are giving them good scholarships now and helping, you know, and that's a place to go today.
What about the one in Pasadena that's gotten so much?